Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, the 19th of August, 1999. We are in the fireside room of Koinonia Building this afternoon. Your presenter's name is Christy Traina. Today's session number is 99.3. Christy continues her series on Christianity and childhood today with her session entitled Children, Rights, and Accountability. Let's listen in.
So, I don't think I'm going to be mentioning much from there today, but I'll leave them out in case anybody's interested. I won't mention too many of the things on that list today. Other days I am using it more. Go ahead. Does that sound like a good idea? And people can come in if they want to. Because I know nobody wants to be late for spinach lasagna. I smelled it as I was in there getting something, and it really smells good. I'm Christy Traina. I teach at Northwestern University in the religion department. And in the last year, I have had the privilege of being involved, and it is a privilege, in a project on Christianity and children, mostly children in the Western theological tradition. And I talked that one to death on Monday, if anyone of you were there. Today I want to do something a little bit different that still draws on those kinds of issues, but also gets us talking and intersecting with contemporary issues with children. One of the reasons why I think discussing the rights, and I think I'm going to end, we may end up going a little more toward the rights of children than toward children as accountable moral agents today, but we'll see what happens. But one of the reasons why I think the rights of children are very, very important today is that in the developed world, there's a fairly recent development. And that is that children are now liabilities rather than assets, economically, okay? It used to be, when we were an agrarian economy, that you had a lot of children because you needed them to work the farm, or you needed them to run the business, or you needed them to do something for you, and the more productive children you had, the better chance you had of being successful. Today, if you say that you're having another baby, people look at you. The first time when we were expecting our first daughter, someone said to us, "Was this planned?" With the implication that if it wasn't, we were irresponsible, and if it was, we were irresponsible because neither one of us had a job at the time. So there's the sense that children are a liability, and as children become liabilities in more of the world, we will be more and more tempted to kind of erode their value in some ways, maybe until that we're a little bit more prosperous across the board. So that's a very, very important reason to be concerned about the rights of children. As I thought of this originally, I had on my mind a bunch of things that would be on my horizon because of being in Chicago. One of them is a columnist in the Chicago Tribune, Bob Green, who writes about his pet issue is children who are abused by parents and who fall through the system's cracks and end up being returned to their families or returned to dangerous situations. And he's had a number of very gripping stories this spring and summer. Also in Chicago, unfortunately, you probably know that there have been a couple of cases recently in which children under the age of 10 were arrested and almost tried for capital crimes, for murders. And in each case, they turned out not to be guilty of those. But what the children had to go through before they were finally released from the justice system and the kind of effect that it's had on them has been very upsetting to the community. finally, in a large city where we are, we're very conscious of the ways in which change in welfare laws especially affect children. It's all very nice to say that their parents ought to earn money and support them, but what if they don't? And so this is something that's been on our horizons. But Jonathan Furyk's talks and some things that I was looking at just before I came, because we all turn in these things early, suggested to me that we might also want to at least think about the global dimension of all of this. We can all think of microcosmic data. I'll give you a couple from our own community, and you might have some to share. One of them is from our, both of them are from our neighborhood schools. We're in what's considered a fairly prosperous suburb of Chicago, Evanston. And in my children's school, at least 50% of the children qualify for free and reduced price lunch and get it. Teachers I've talked to at the school are quite sure that there are a number of children who qualify and whose families don't request it. Okay. So we're talking about an affluent suburb, okay, in which, in this school, more than half the students are below a level of income that can happily support anybody in an urban area, and most of whom don't have, and the ones who fall in between the real poverty line and the reduced price lunch line probably don't have medical insurance because they fall in that gap where Medicaid doesn't go. Another datum from our area is that about 40% of Mexican-American students and probably 15 to 20% of African-American students don't graduate from high school. They drop out. Okay. This is to be compared with a white dropout rate that is virtually nil. Okay. There are many, many reasons. Some of them are linguistic, some of them have to do with poverty, some of them have to do with transience. But the bottom line is that what happens is that the kids that drop out because they didn't have whatever they needed in elementary school. And we live in a state where the elementary districts have, and the high school districts are completely separate, so there's no accountability between them, you know. So these are justice issues in our backyards. So that's sort of frame one. Frame two, just to get a sense of what we're talking about when we're talking about children's rights, I pulled a few pieces of data off the UNICEF webpage, which you might be interested in looking at if you ever have a chance, if you're on the internet when you go home, or back to visit relatives if you're on staff. If we look at the United States, we see that children are actually fairly small in comparison with the rest of the world, percentage of our population, just about a quarter. Our mortality rate is quite low, 8 per 1,000 births, and that's under the age of 5. Okay, so 8 children, out of 1,000 children born, only 8 won't make it to their 5th birthday. Okay, households with iodized sight, well, that sounds like a really silly statistic, right? Unless, until you start to look down, right? Everybody can get iodized salts. Our per capita gross national product is almost $27,000. That doesn't mean everybody partakes in that, right? But there's the potential there for people to. Our fertility rate per woman, per fertile woman, is 2. Children are not underweight. They're sometimes born underweight, yes, but children are not underweight. And pretty much all of our children are in school. Okay. For some funny statistical reasons, it doesn't show up as 100% in the data, but it's about 100%. Then we go to the Sudan, which has been ripped by civil war for a long time. In the Sudan, children make up almost 45% of the population. Infant mortality is almost 20 times higher. Child mortality is almost 20 times higher. There are no data that I could find on iodized salt, but you can see the difference in the gross national product and in the fertility rate, almost 2.5 times higher. The percent of children that are underweight, and this isn't just at birth, but while growing up, is over a third, and maybe half, a little over half the kids of primary school age are in primary school. Does anybody know why the fertility rate is so high? Have any hints?
Probably less birth control.
Less birth control. Right, and in a chaotic situation like war, it's hard to get that kind of thing. Any other ideas? Yeah.
If you have a lot of children dying, you may tend to have more to keep your population up.
The expectation is that you need to have several in order to keep a few.
Right.
Also in areas, and I didn't put literacy rates for men and women on this, but in virtually all developing nations, the literacy rate for women is much lower than the literacy rate for men. And low fertility is correlated with high levels of education for women. Okay. That, in a sense, is why the U.S., one of the reasons why the U.S. has a low fertility rate, because we have high levels of education for women. Okay. It's not absolutely causal, but it's closely correlated. Did you have a question? It looked like a hand, I'm sorry. In Haiti, which is closer by, and is a place where, I don't know, do any of your churches have connections to parishes in Haiti? It's one of those places where American churches often link up to help out.
We had two nations on the road
today. Oh, I didn't realize they were from Haiti. Okay. All right. So you probably know these statistics.
I met this family here. Okay. From Victoria, British Columbia.
Okay.
And she had adopted both of her children.
Okay. So they would have been familiar with this. We're moving up toward half the population, children under 18. The infant mortality rate is even higher. Households with iodized salt, we at least have a figure, but it's only 10. And that's such an important nutrient. The gross national product is even lower. Fertility rate's about the same. A little less underweight, a little more education, but still a really grim picture for kids, especially when you compare it with the American picture. Now again, I'm not saying that American children really have at their fingertips $27,000 a piece. Of course they don't, and that's one of our problems. But we have the resources to get that much to them, and that's kind of the difference here.
Are you saying then that that's basically what the welfare system is capable of putting out per family?
Well, no, that's if you divide the gross national product by number of people in the United States, that's how much there is. That's the share of each for each person. Okay. So no, that doesn't mean that that's what we can. That doesn't mean that we can open up the federal coffers and provide that, and state coffers and provide that. It just means that if someone is scraping by on about $2,000 or $3,000 a year, they're getting less than their fair share, in a sense. Yeah. In a sense. In many of these societies, there's a very small elite, but. There wouldn't be a lot of room for a big elite with that kind of gross national product. One of the questions for us today, and I'm going to do a little talking at first, but then I hope we can open up and share some thoughts about this, is what kind of ammunition or material does the Christian tradition give us to talk about rights of children? If you were with me Monday, I think I made the picture on children in the Western traditions sound pretty dismal. But one of the interesting things about Western thinkers and Western doers, because when you want to look at the Western tradition on children, you actually have to look at what people do more than what they say, is that whatever they might say about the relationship of children to God, they're adamant that children have value, need to be protected and educated, and they're also anxious to go and do it. In Western history. I mentioned this on Monday, but not all of you might have been there. One example is the early Christian communities and childhood, and Jim Martin Schramm has very kindly reminded me about a book that I would like to read and he might want to share with you, which mentions that one of the attractions for non-Christians to the early Christian community was that it valued children. We have to think back to the Greco-Roman societies in which children who were not wanted were exposed or killed. A high proportion of female children, because male children were more valuable to a family. Female children, pretty much all the way up to the present, have been considered in the West as a liability rather than an asset. Okay. And Christians argued against exposure, argued against infanticide. Okay? And this, for many people, was an attractive point about the Christian community. Judy Gundry Wolf has mentioned that the significance of Jesus taking up children in the New Testament is that those children were really the last class of citizens of their society. If us men who are servants or in some kind of slavery contract were sort of second class citizens and women were third, then kids were way down at the bottom. Okay. There is a gap in the Christian tradition between ideal and reality here. Okay? Christians say immediately, children are important, children should be protected, children should not be killed, abortion would be a bad thing. If you might do it, and people, even religious people, even participated in finding concoctions that would cause abortion, but you didn't really talk about it, right? It wasn't promoted, okay? And infanticide was certainly frowned upon, as was abandonment. However, there is a big gap between ideal and practice. If you want a fascinating book, you might want to read John Boswell's book, The Kindness of Strangers, which is about abandonment in the Middle Ages, actually a larger period than that. And he, some people think he exaggerates, but even if he exaggerates, the problem was phenomenal, children just being left or nearly left who were unwanted. Okay, so even though there was a prohibition, there was an incredible practice of abandonment. The kinds of questions this ends up raising for people who are dealing with it in Christian history, though, are kind of complicated. For instance, if a child is religiously a person, if a child is someone who should be baptized, who should be protected by God, who should be raised, who shouldn't be killed or abandoned, does that mean that civilly or civically they're a person, or politically are they a person? Most of the time, in most of Christian history, up till about the 18th or 19th century, it didn't mean that at all. Secondly, is the child a person in the making, sort of a piece of, sort of half-baked, and your job is to kind of finish the baking? Or is the person a whole person with all the rights appertaining thereunto, or something like that? And this may sound like a dumb question, but it's one that troubles us now. A very striking sermon I heard recently mentioned this. Said that, I've always heard that children are the church of tomorrow, so we should educate them and care for them because they're tomorrow's church. And the preacher said, they're not tomorrow's church. They're the church of today. There's this difference in perspective. You know, are they the people who will be the people of God, or are they the people of God? Also, there's this lingering disagreement, and this comes out of this whole discussion about original sin that we touched on the other day. Are children seeds of sin, or are they blank slates? Right? And what they deserve, what they need in order to flourish, what their rights are going to be very different if they're seeds of sin than if they are blank slates or lumps of clay needing to be molded or something like that. So how you look at them theologically also turns out to have some kind of impact on how you view their rights. Okay. What are some ways in which the Christian tradition that you can think of, either in its practices or in its theology, has supported the idea, yeah, that it provides us with some building blocks for forming children's rights? She's almost ready to do it, isn't she? Almost pulling it. But are there some ways in which you can think of the tradition or things people have said as supporting children as beings with rights of their own, and not just subsets of families? Some ways, maybe implicitly, that that's worked out.
I would think that one of the things that we do is we educate them in the faith, you know, by having the Sunday school and getting them baptized and having confirmation. And, I mean, to me, that in itself is saying that they are already a human being.
Right. And the fact that so many people argued for infant baptism means that children were valued because you wouldn't bother otherwise, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, medieval theologians even said that a parent who did not baptize their child, a Christian parent who didn't baptize their child, would commit a mortal sin. In other words, would be damned to hell for failing to do so. It wasn't the kid's fault, it was theirs. And that means that the child is valuable. Baptism is a really important one, and so is the education part. In fact, Christians have educated children not only religiously, right, but have taught people how to read and write. Whom did the federal government tap to set up Indian schools, right? The churches, right? Now, that's not saying that they did a good job or that they didn't create cultural problems, but that was the church's task, to educate the uneducated. August Planck, the pietist theologian, also set up schools. John Wesley set up schools. The idea was to educate everybody. Any other pieces that you can think of that help us with finding the material for a theory of rights for children?
Well, along the same, as the missionaries went out and educated, we had a lot of mission medical fields worldwide, and even now, I know a lot of church organizations are involved in nationally, internationally, in helping with medical and poverty and vaccinations.
Their task is aimed a lot at reproductive health and child health, right? And, so that's another indicator of that. In fact, Christians are supporting the rights of children and value children. Any others?
Christian, you talked the other day about Martin Luther's insistence that the child, the infant baby, be baptized right off the bat. I mean, earlier the better.
Right.
And I'm wondering if his reasoning behind that, if perhaps one of his motivations behind that was that in that baptismal process, there's kind of a contractual obligation implicitly by the parent to the child, and you know, a Christian education and that sort of thing, or if it was just more of a theological argument he was trying to settle in his mind.
I'm not enough of a Luther scholar to tell you what percentage, you know, of the arguments was based on each of those factors, but I would say that I think that the cultural piece, the community piece, was very important for him. Okay. He wanted children to be educated early. He wanted their parents to read them Bible stories. And baptism does get you into the church, right? And does make you a piece of the church community, which then becomes responsible for you. But the theological part was a big part, too. He was convinced that if you weren't baptized, you were lost. And so that was there as well.
Yeah. Didn't it come from the Catholicism before that?
Right. I mean, Luther, we think of Luther as the person who wanted to get rid of everything Romish and papist. He really wasn't in a lot of ways. His sensibilities, especially sacramentally, eucharistically and with the sacrament of baptism, were pretty close in many ways to the Roman ones, at least in terms of when and how often you should practice it and how significant it was. Mm-hmm. Right. There was some comment in the back.
I don't think that children are mentioned in that passage, but certainly by extension, I think it would follow that if we are all equal in Christ. There is no more Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female. By extension, it would seem to me, adult or child, and any time that a child is being abused or not given the kind of things that we believe are human rights, then that would speak for our caring for that child or doing something for that child.
Right. And I think that's a good point, because in that passage, those aren't equal categories. Those are unequals. Jew and Greek are not equal. Slave and free are not equal. Male and female are not equal. It's not just, you know, chocolate and vanilla, right? So it's a very important point that, yes, that it would fit the same paradigm. I think you're right on with that. Anything else? Historically, there are a couple of fascinating things that come in. One of them has to do with marriage. And there's an enormous tension in Christian history, and this may be something that we're beginning to forget on the cusp of the 21st century. But there was an incredible tension historically between a child's obligation to obey his or her parents and the child as an autonomous self, as a self-directing, independent person. We tend to think that up until very recently, children were not at all considered to be independent beings, that they were completely under their parents' control. Fascinatingly, this isn't true, and this is one of the places where we can really mine history. Thomas Aquinas, and if I mention him a few times today, it's because he's one of my more familiar people, but it's nice to know this goes back before the Reformation. Thomas Aquinas said that a child could not make any sort of solemn vow before puberty. And so that meant that adults could not arrange marriages for their little children and carry them out. And it also meant that if adults picked out mates that their children didn't like, they didn't have to marry them, whatever age they were. So Thomas Aquinas interestingly said that secret marriages were valid marriages. Why? So that you would not be boxed in by your families who might force you to marry someone against your will. He also said that any kind of vow made under duress or without complete understanding was not valid. So he protected children from their parents, both in terms of their parents' choices of marriage partners, and in case their parents might want to tie them to a monastery or dump them on a monastery. Children were not required to stay at monasteries. Once they reached the age of puberty, they could say, I like this life, I want to stay. Or no, thank you, I'd like to leave. Now, we won't talk about the economic problems that leaving a monastery at 14 might cause you. That did prohibit people from leaving because they didn't have dowries anymore and they didn't have inheritances anymore. But still, they had the right to go. What's fascinating about this is that at the Reformation, family life is perceived to have been devalued by medieval people. So people like Martin Luther, John Calvin, are very interested in resurrecting family life. The what we would now call the nuclear family, with mother, father, and children. And making that kind of the paradigmatic, the normative structure for Christian life, whereas celibacy or singleness, vowed singleness, had been the normative, the absolute best way of leading life before. And what happens is that Luther and Calvin and others set up a really strong ethic of obedience to parents. Okay? The parent is God. What's very interesting about this is what happens in Luther, and I'm going to read to you something from a paper by Jane Stroll, whom some of you here probably know. Roman Catholic canon law recognized secret marriages, but Luther didn't. Okay? Why? Because they violate the commandment to obey father and mother. Okay? Luther believed that a child should not become engaged or marry without parental knowledge and consent, and that if he or she did so, the parents had the authority to dissolve the union. However, he also insisted that such interference must be for substantive reasons. He didn't concede to parents the authority arbitrarily to prevent a child's marriage, and he condemned any attempt to compel a child to marry against his or her will. So he didn't want parents to interfere. But if they did the child have to obey? Well, he says that a true Christian wouldn't either refuse or resist a forced marriage, but would render filial obedience, would obey his or her parents anyway, trusting in Christ to preserve her from the potentially disastrous consequences. Ah. But then Luther asks, where are there such Christians who could do so? In other words, who could obey their parents, go through with the marriage, and cross their fingers and pray? Well, he must teach only what is Christian, but weak souls, unable to face the risks of such obedience, may appeal for help from the civil realm. And so he hopes that the state will help them out. He says, although a Christian is in duty bound to tolerate injustice, the temporal authority is also under obligation to punish and prevent such injustice and to guard and uphold the right. And if they can't get help from the civil authorities, what do? They're supposed to flee the country, okay? Escape their parents, escape their spouse, and go to some other place. So Luther, whereas the medievals build a fence around this freedom of children, Luther can't quite do that. The only way to escape your parents' choice for you is to go. Okay. So around the Reformation, it actually became in some ways more difficult to delineate the rights of children rather than less. We tend to think of ourselves as kind of on this upward curve, and we took a little dip down there. Hopefully we're on our way back up. Another way of demonstrating care for children even before all of these schools that were built around the Reformation was that abandoned children were also often cared for in monasteries. So there's a good tradition there. Any other comments on these developments or what this might yield for us in terms of a list of rights? Yes.
Aren't there two ways of looking at, I mean, there's always two sides to the story,
yes.
But sometimes the parent knows the child so well and you could see them making a mistake, and so that maybe they had the right reasons for this, but then, you know, things get generalized and it doesn't work out that way, or?
Yeah. Luther's hope was that the parents would be good Christian parents who knew their children well, who were looking out for their welfare, and were saying, oh, stop, that one doesn't look so good. Especially because you didn't want to dissolve this, right? So yes, that was his hope. But he was writing his recommendations for the people who were perfect. And the interesting thing is that he didn't leave such good loopholes for those whose parents might, out of self-interest, try to create an alliance or a marriage. So you're right, yes, his intention was marvelous. His intention was very pure-hearted. It was more of the danger that might lurk if that wasn't followed. Any other thoughts on those? Where this gets us. Okay. One of the things that happens in the Reformation period, especially around the Calvinists in Geneva, is that this line between what might be morally good to do and what's legal gets very, very thin, because they want to create a society in which everyone's Christian and living according to the Christian ideals. And so rather than leaving some distance between laws and moral recommendations, they begin to merge pretty closely. And that we can talk about a little bit later. Any other dimensions, or does anybody have any ideas about any principles or guiding factors that we could get out of the things that we've mentioned so far? What are the rights of children in the Christian tradition, does it seem? And how are they debased? It seems to be, if we could pull out of all of this some rights, what would we say?
Choice.
Okay. About whether to have ice cream before or after dinner.
For instance, in marriages and things like that.
Okay. So maybe marriage and religion. Mm-hmm. Okay. Interestingly enough, you would think that medievals would be so devoted to the idea of baptism that they would want to baptize everybody, you know, that they would just go out and look for people to baptize and sort of pull them in off the streets and do it against their parents' will. Fascinatingly enough, they didn't. Because that would have violated the integrity of the family from which the child came. You couldn't baptize a child without its parents' consent. That would be wrong, because that would violate the family unit. And that is a benefit and a liability and some of the problems we have with defining children's rights today. Any other ones you want to put up?
Protection.
Okay.
You mean protection as a child's right?
Yeah.
Right, so protection from violence and...
How about nurturing?
Okay.
The love part.
Now, there are many, many, many studies which tell us today that children need physical and emotional nurturing at a very young age in order to develop at all. Right.
Society kind of puts a damper on that with the two-parent incomes and the daycares and everything like that.
Right. You either don't do it or you make that somebody else's job for a lot of the day. Yeah.
And all the divorces. And
yeah, it's at risk, isn't it? Partly because of the way our society is organized economically. I mean, this is... Does anybody know why AFDC was created? AIDS Families with Dependent Children? Does anybody know? Some of you probably do remember this. Mm-hmm. What was the purpose of it? Bless you.
Would it be a child that was had terminal illness, families could take the leave? Is that what you're talking about?
No, this goes way back. It's welfare. What we now know is welfare. The purpose of AIDS Families with Dependent Children was so that women could stay home and take care of their own preschoolers without having to work. Okay? It was to preserve the family unit so women could take care of their own children until they were school-aged. That was the idea. Okay? And now you see where it's gone, right? Aid to Families with Dependent Children is now a way to help out lazy women. And who really should be putting their kids in daycare while they work. You see how our philosophy has changed over the last 40 or 50 years about how children should be raised and what a valuable contribution, a valuable adult contribution society consists. Right? It has changed. Yes.
Also, quality of care is so important, because you can be home all day with your child if you have no quality of nurturing with that child. Well, then you might as well be off working, and maybe a daycare person would do a better job.
Right. So whoever's providing it, there needs to be nurturing, and it needs to be attentive, right? And that is, it's something that children not only ought to have, but can't develop without, we have learned now. They can't develop without it at all. Any other pieces we might want to throw in here?
Could you say that, this is sort of the same thing, but could you say that that from a Christian point of view, the child has a right to a good family, because then if you have a good family, then obedience make sense. It doesn't make sense if you don't, if you have abusive parents or... Then how can you honor your father and mother? I mean, we can't get away from the fact that there was a fourth commandment and...
Right. And what has happened is that people have taken, well, the writings of Luther or the writings of a lot of people that talk about obedience to parents and haven't thought about the fact that Luther was assuming a strong family when he said that, or that Calvin was assuming a strong family most of the time. Although there are, many of our Western theologians have thought that a little suffering wasn't bad for us. And they extended that, as we learned when we heard about Jonathan Edwards on Monday, to children. They didn't mind if children suffered a little. It was good for their character, or else they deserved it, one or the other. Okay,
well, what about the right to be born a drug-free and without in the home too? Also, you know, there's smoking and things like that. But they really have the right to have a healthy environment, both before, during pregnancy, and afterwards.
Right. This is not only an emotionally strong family, right? Or in a relationally strong family, but a healthy environment, and we could talk about that microcosmically, that is, in the household, right? And we can also talk about that macrocosmically, in the environment's global environment, right? If you live in a heavily polluted area, it's just as bad for you or worse if you live in a house where there's smoking, etc., right? If you have a pretty strong family, but there's drug selling all around you, then that's still going to be a hazard, right? And that goes with the protection. Okay, anything else?
What about just the right to a future? I mean, when you think of nuclear weapons, or you think of global warming, or holes in the ozone layer, and you know, you get your kids get to a certain age and they say, I don't think I want to have kids because they may not have a future.
Right, the right to life we have sort of shut that phrase down because we've been identifying it with the abortion question. But if we open the right to life up again, as some groups are doing for us, the right to have a world to inherit, right?
Yeah.
That is a right, which we've all assumed, right? We've all assumed we have.
Or some place where there's open space. You know,
right.
Some place where there are trees and mountains and things.
Right, and leave enough of that stuff in place that the ecosystem continues to function. Right. Even if you never get to see it, it's still making oxygen and creating rain for you. Anything else? I'd like to move some things over from here. Education is one. Medical care, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was that?
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah. Food, very important one. When we looked at the figures on underweight, a figure I'm going to be dealing with next week, but is also pertinent here. When we talk about grain usage per person in the United States, okay, and in India, that includes the grain that we use to eat, the grain that we use to feed our cows, and the grain that we use to feed the animals we slaughter. Okay, we use 4.5 times as much grain per person as India. All right. That means there's a significant difference in nutrition. Now, actually, they tell us that we use more than we should use to be healthy, that we would be healthier if we used about 400 or 500 pounds per about half what we now use as Americans. But the fact is that there's an incredible imbalance in the amount of nutrients available to people in parts of the world. And the places where nutrients are marginal now are the places where they are scheduled to decline the fastest in the next 50 years or so. And who misses out when there is a food shortage?
Children.
The kids. That's right. And Jennifer has been talking about that too. There are economic causes behind this as well. Any other things we want to add to this? Okay. What you have all come up with very closely matches the details in the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. Does anybody know about this? Okay. It is a document that was started in 1979, finished in early 1990, and opened up for signing and ratification. It's a document that says children have the right to a healthy family life, or if they can't have one, to be adopted. They have the right to all of these things that we've listed out. They have the right, and that the government has responsibilities to make sure that families can provide these things. In other words, if the parents are responsible for providing a livelihood for the child, the state is responsible for providing a situation in which that's possible for a family. Okay? And so it talks about the responsibilities of families, but especially of states and of the international community toward children. And this would be kind of a shorthand list, okay, of the document. If you want to take a look at it, you might want to look on the UNICEF webpage, because it gives the whole document. I've got a copy of it with me, but I don't have Xeroxes of it. Now, there are two nations that have not ratified this agreement. Any guesses?
U.S. States of Canada.
Yeah, U.S. And the only other country that has not ratified it,
China.
No, is a country that has not ratified it because it has no internationally recognized government at the moment, and that's Somalia. Okay? China has ratified. Canada has. The United States signed it, but the president has not yet passed it to the Senate for ratification. Why not? Because some people erroneously believe that this would erode American interests, or would in some way force other kinds of social change, force contraception, or force other sorts of things. Which, if you read it carefully, it doesn't. Anyway, we are the only country with a recognized functioning government that hasn't ratified this. Okay? And it's a philosophical thing, of course, it has no teeth in it, but it lays out what the rights of children are and how they ought to be protected. Okay? And if you have the will to do so, it would probably be a great idea to write to your senator and to request that he or she request that this be presented to the Senate, because we're the only country that hasn't. It's an important thing.
Would it be a good idea maybe for congregations to talk about this and maybe
it absolutely
write letters?
It would be great to do that. Do you have internet access? Okay, you can look it up on the UNICEF homepage. They have a sample letter, which actually itself is out of date because it says only four countries have not ratified. But in the more in the updated webpage, it says only two, us and Somalia. So it would be a great idea. A marvelous project for one of those letter writing Sundays during coffee hour would be to write your senators about this, because it's something that it's important to have our nation, as others have said this week, when we do something, it's significant in the world. And we need to get behind this one, because as Christians and as citizens of the world, we need to say this is what our children deserve.
Okay. It's like in the UN Declaration?
It's the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And by the way, it according to UNICEF, it has broken all the records as the most widely ratified human rights treaty in history. Okay, and Americans, Canadians, you're exonerated, but Americans are not yet on the bandwagon. So it's something that we need to think and pray about, and try to get our country to support, because it's an important philosophical statement, and hopefully a great deal could follow from it. You can see the connection between the figures that I put up, the concerns that you have all raised, and things that have been mentioned this week about Jubilee 2000 as well. Because until debt loads are lessened and until development is carried out in a more responsible way, there won't, many of these countries will not have the resources to actually put these rights into practice themselves. But so it's an interdependent system that we need to attack from lots of different directions. Okay, other comments on rights? Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about accountability and children. And this is maybe just a brief introduction to John Marty's session rather than a full full discussion. What kinds of conversations have gone on in your congregations and in your families since the Columbine shootings and other events that recently have involved students and guns? What kinds of things have you been hearing and saying about responsibility and kids?
We have talked a lot about the fact that it seems like the games, the violent games and computer games and other types of movies and things like that, that we feel that is a really, really bad thing, and that's not the whole thing, but these particular kids were pretending to shoot people so long that then it just wasn't a real thing to them anymore.
Mm-hmm. So in ethics, there's a technical term for it, which we call virtue theory. And virtue has kind of, it's not our most popular good word these days. When you talk about virtue, most people look at you sideways and think of somebody who's kind of a goody two-shoes. But in the Western ethical tradition, both Christian and philosophical, the idea that we create ourselves, that we create tendencies within ourselves by repeating certain kinds of actions over and over again. And if those are good, we've created in ourselves a tendency to do the good thing. And if they're not, we created in ourselves a tendency to do the bad one. And it might be that what you're suggesting is that some of these games create in people what we call a vice, the opposite of a virtue, which is a tendency or a habit that makes this seem comfortable or not so horrifying to them.
Or not out of the ordinary or something.
Right, right.
And the parents must have been very busy because they didn't even know they were building bombs and things. So
there was an accountability that spreads to the family. Right, there. Any other thoughts on accountability and kids? How responsible, I guess, are kids, school kids, for something like the Columbine shootings? What degree of responsibility do they bear?
Well, I think from a very, very early age, we're all accountable for our actions. We're accountable for what we say. You know, more so as adults, of course, because we're already supposed to be schooled and know everything. But even as kids, I think that there is a certain accountability that they have for what they say and do. You know, granted, they get it from their parents. They get their values and their morals from their parents, and and stuff, but at some point they have to be accountable.
Is there a difference between being morally responsible for something and being legally accountable for it?
Yes.
Yeah. Like, for instance, what are some examples that come up?
Well, you may have a child out of wedlock, or even a child with a spouse, and if you divorce and decide not to support that child, legally you can be held accountable for it, but morally that person may not see anything wrong with it, especially if, say it's an unwed mother and you weren't married and she chooses not to file your name with the state as the father.
Mm-hmm.
Well, morally, a person of integrity might feel obligated, but if you don't feel obligated, then you legally wouldn't be obligated.
Right. So what's demanded of us morally is greater than what's demanded of us legally most of the time, in many cases.
Well, maybe some children aren't even taught, you know, right from wrong, or that some things are wrong to do, you know, even as little children. Yeah. And they're not held accountable, you know, at a young age, maybe, for
yeah.
the little things they do. I think if we focus just on evil all day long, or look at those video games that are so repellent, you know, I don't think that's a very distorted view of life, if that's all you would focus on.
Right.
Those type of things. TV programs that are real sordid.
If this isn't interrupted.
Right.
With anything else positive.
Then aren't they really accountable? Because it's like our child that wants to just eat junk food.
Yeah, you want to see that all the time.
Are they going to be accountable for that? Or are we parents supposed to step in and say, this isn't, right, you know, this isn't good for you? You have to, I think you have to interrupt a bad thing that's happening.
Right. So is the child that's not interrupted accountable? Really?
Good question.
I mean,
that's a great question.
Some don't have very much supervision, maybe, either. Maybe
I think the responsibility in large falls on society as a whole. I mean, as parents, we are even legally accountable for our kids to a certain extent, but society sets us up in a lot of ways to fail because of the two-parent incomes. You know, nobody is home to take care of the kids. We're at the mercy of the values of the daycare that we take our kids to, you know. So I think we're accountable, but yet if you look at the picture as a whole, society doesn't make it easy to raise a child. I think that society takes away a lot of the rights of parents, okay, and gives them to the kids. And then we're held accountable for that child's actions, but we're not given the tools to have that child under control. You know, that's been my experience anyway. It's been very frustrating as a parent.
It's true, especially, I think many people who come to Holden with kids can probably choose between, if they're married, between having one or one and a half and two incomes. But many people who don't make it to Holden actually can't choose that. Have to have all the adults in the household working. And they really are in the box, right? Because it's not, well, do I stay home with my children or do I fulfill my professional dreams? It's, well, if we're gonna pay the rent and buy groceries, I guess I have to go to work also. And they have the least acceptable childcare options. One of our most pressing national problems is a lack of adequate childcare, right? Or if you wanna put it the other way, a lack of a family support adequate enough so that some adult in the household can stay home. I mean, you can say it either way. It works either way. But it is a problem because you don't have if your society, and I think we're now coming around back to what I said at the beginning, in a society in which children are a liability rather than an asset economically, and in a society whose values are so strongly driven by economics, it makes it very hard to make an argument in favor of children. And that is why we have to do it so hard, so loudly, because they're not going to be automatically pitched for by anybody. We need to stay on their side because they don't vote, right? They will vote, but they don't yet, right?
But it's important we don't push that to an extreme too, you know, in the effort to totally protect children's rights, to actually take them away from the parents.
Right, and I like what you said, because you've talked about how it's probably just as important or more important to create a society that is child-friendly, mm-hmm. as it is to say, okay, here's list of parents' rights, here's list of kids' rights, let's move one from the parent column to the kid column. That makes you uncomfortable, right? But I think what I'm hearing you say is that what we need to do is create a society that is hospitable to children, which will allow parents to do a better job of being parents. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's not going to happen unless we're all in there pitching, because it's not the direction in which our economy and our political system naturally move. Okay, it's very tough. How many of you live in states with some sort of spending limits or on education? I do. Okay, property tax caps or Proposition 13 or something mm-hmm. like that. Okay.
Well, I think we were the beginning. We had Prop 13,
right? I live in a city with virtually no industry and property tax caps. Bad thing, mm-hmm. right? We can see where this goes. We're moving in on lasagna time, so I want to say only this, that the Christian tradition too has carefully, historically distinguished between a child's accountability to God and their accountability to the state. And that's something we need to keep in mind. We have a long history of graded responsibility, of saying that a child can't really commit any kind of heinous sin or crime before the age of reason, whatever that is, and that until full adulthood, even if we can convict them of murder, even if we can convict them of drug dealing, even if we can convict them of whatever we can, their punishment should not be the same as an adult punishment. And along with this UN Convention on the Child, by the way, we should try to train them in a new direction, to instill virtue in them and make them productive members of society. When we're talking about children convicted as criminals or children suffering crimes as victims, we need to try to keep that in mind, that although they may be accountable before God, as a society we owe them some training in virtue and some benefits so that they can develop fully. And need to consider them not quite as responsible or cognizant of their actions as adults. If we let that go, then we will have gone back centuries and even millennia in our understanding of children and their accountability and rights.